Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Each episode, I'm talking to performers from film, television and theatre about one significant role in their career. It might not always be the role they're most famous for, but in each one, I'll be trying to find out about the preparation, the excitement, and the sense of nostalgia that goes with any key role in an actor's lifetime. The acclaimed theatre director Peter Hall referred to Geraldine James as one of the great English classical actresses. Graduating from Drama Centre, she embarked on a theatre career that would see her nominated for a Tony and winning the Drama Desk Award for her role as Portia in the Broadway revival of The Merchant of Venice. Her film credits include Gandhi, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and 45 Years. Since 2017, she has starred in the Netflix series Anne with an E. Geraldine has been nominated 4 times for the BAFTA TV Best Actress Award for Dummy, Band of Gold, The Sins, and The Jewel in the Crown, where she played the character Sarah Layton. I caught up with her to talk about that experience earlier this year. Hello, welcome to the show. And my guest today is Geraldine James, the wonderful Geraldine James. And we'll be talking about Jewel in the Crown from 1984 and her character Sarah Layton. I've covered this in the podcast before because I've spoken to Charles Dance, of course. Charles actually did say that because you'd been in India before, you were sort of like team leader for them all when they got there. But you must have great fond memories of this time, do you?
It was incredible. I'd been there on Gandhi the year before. Mm-hmm. And in my research for my English character in Gandhi, I'd read everything I could about India, and I read the Raj Quartet. And it was an extraordinary experience. It's the only time in my life I've actually read a book where I saw myself completely reflected in a character. I felt so connected with that character, Sarah Layton. And Dickie Attenborough, who was directing Gandhi, said to me one day, "Have you ever read anything in literature that you'd like to play?" And I said, "Yes." Funnily enough, I'm reading it now, the Raj Quartet. And he said, "Oh, they're doing that. Granada Television are doing a series of that." So I thought, I was in India, and I thought, oh, well, there you are. That's gone. And when I got back to London, I spoke to my agent and said, "Do you know anything about this Raj Quartet?" And he said, "Yes, you're up for it. You've got an audition next week for the part of Daphne Manners," which is the other part. And I had this extraordinary dilemma when I got there and met the directors, Chris Morahan and Jim O'Brien. I told them I'd read the book and I'd absolutely loved it. And they said, "Do you connect to any character in particular?" And I had that terrible moment of going, do I tell them the truth and say Sarah Layton, and they'll go, "Oh, sorry, that's been cast." Or do I know I'm up for Daphne Manners. Do I go, "Yes, I'd love to play Daphne Manners," which wouldn't have been strictly speaking true. So I plunged in and I said, Sarah Layton. And I took about 8 months to convince them that I really could play it.
Sorry, 8 months?
8 months. I'd done something on telly. I played Emma Hamilton in a very weird series about Nelson, Horatio Nelson. I played Emma Hamilton. And I had to put on a lot of padding and a lot of weight. So I was this massive Emma Hamilton, because she was huge. She was like 5'9", had huge feet. And they'd seen that, and they went, "No, that terrifying woman couldn't possibly be our Sarah Layton." So I had to keep going back in, reading more and more episodes for them, and talking about what I felt about the character and why I felt I understood her so well. And eventually they went, okay, yep, it's yours.
And what was it that drew you to Sarah? What was it, what qualities that you, from the book, did you really chime with you?
A couple of things. I knew absolutely nothing. My father was a doctor. He was nothing to do with the military. I knew nothing about India other than what I'd seen traipsing about in a sari after Ben Kingsley for 4 months on Gandhi. But the character, she has a younger sister. I had a younger sister. And we had a very sort of sparky relationship. She was always the pretty one. I was the clever one and the musical one. And we had huge battles between us. My mother drank, and Sarah Leighton's mum, Mildred, was a heavy drinker. And there was a scene in the book, I don't think it was even in the scripts eventually, but there was a scene in the book where they go to a public loo, they're in ladies' loos, and she's in a cubicle next to her mother, and she can hear the rattle of a bottle being taken out of a brown paper bag, and she knows what's going on next door. And I said, that's what I grew up doing. And I think that sort of experience gives you a way into an understanding of that extraordinary character, Sarah, because she was so internalized and she felt so out of place and so different from all the people, all the sort of posh young British people. Her heart was for the native people and for the, you know, she sort of considered what it was like to be one of those servants who her mother just treated, just sort of bashed about and just didn't treat well at all.
She has great empathy, doesn't she?
Extraordinary. Yeah. And I just responded to that very, very, very strongly. And there's a lot of that is to do with being a child of an alcoholic. Because we sort of have extended antennae. You know, we walk into a room and suss. We go, there's a danger point. I'm safe here. I can't go and talk to those people over there. And you have this extraordinary wide view of any room you go into.
Mm-hmm. It fascinates me, though, that, you know, Chris and Jim, the directors, they were very, very experienced. But even they look at the last character you played and go, oh, that's what she does. They don't, you know, you have to sort of convince them that you're an actress, that you can inhabit different roles.
Yeah, absolutely. But in fairness to them, I think it was Dennis Foreman, who I absolutely adored, who was our sort of major, major exec producer at Granada.
Yeah.
And he actually said to me once, he came out to India and he said, I was the one who didn't want you to play this part.
Oh,
it was me. I didn't want you to do it because I saw you play Emma Hamilton. And he'd seen a thing I did way back, a thing called Dummy.
Yes.
When I played a profoundly deaf prostitute in Bradford, sort of opposite to Sarah Leighton. Mm. And people just do have this idea that actors can't, what I like to call, transform. You know, we approach a character, and if it's hopefully different from a character we've played before, then we try to make this character real and truthful. Mm-hmm. But if you've been successful in that, then people go, oh, no, well, you can't do that because you did that believably and successfully. So you're sort of hoist by your own petard in a way.
I mean, looking through, you know, for the interview, obviously, I went back and looked at quite a lot of your work. I mean, it's so diverse. I mean, you do challenge yourself in very, very different roles. I mean, that's what you love as well, isn't it? It's about
totally.
Inhabiting.
But I've never wanted to be myself. That's why I've never been a star. I have never been a star. I've never been particularly recognized because I hope that I'm quite different in different things I do. And I think essentially in the first place, I wanted to become an actor because I didn't want to be myself. So I had to pretend to be somebody else, as I'm sure most of us somewhere down the line did.
But there's Jewel in the Crown was such a phenomenal success. That must have changed for you just walking down the street. The people must have recognized you then. I mean, it was event television, wasn't it?
Jewel was absolutely extraordinary. I remember that Tim, Charlie, Art, Susie, I think, and me all went to New York for a Beano, that was sort of when they were showing some episode, a great big press do. But I remember walking down a street in New York and being mobbed and being absolutely terrified because these people came out and sort of grabbed me and wanted to take me in and sort of sit me down and give me cups of tea and whatever. And it was it was quite extraordinary. I had the most amazing letters from people who, of course, thought I was Sarah Leighton and would talk to me about their issues and what they should do and how I could help. And please, would I go and have tea with them and all of this. I mean, that's the only time in my life when I did Band of Gold.
Yes.
People used to stop me in the street and are you working?
A very different sort of adulation.
Sort of person there.
But during the filming, I mean, 8 months, I mean, that's unheard of today. You know, you go for a job and they say, can you start
18
on Monday?
18 months, David.
Yes, 18 months filming, but 8 months between you going up for getting the part.
Yes, yes.
I mean, in that 8 months of convincing them, just talk me through that. Are you going in? Are you reading? Are you reading with other actors?
There were 14 episodes. And the unique thing about that show was, there were 13 to start with. They liked the rushes so much, they gave us an extra episode. But all the scripts were done.
Amazing.
Amazing. Unheard of. There were the 13 full one-hour scripts.
That was Ken Taylor. Ken Taylor,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Brilliant, brilliant scripts. I never met Paul Scott, tragically, but...
But also, that wasn't that unusual. I mean, it's unusual in the sense that it's 14 hours or 13 hours. But I remember... You know, I always started a job and had all the scripts. You know, it's relatively recently that we've started jobs.
Absolutely. Where you're getting the words the night before you. Yeah. Absolutely.
But what a job. What a great screenplay it is. You know, it's wonderful writing.
But so I had all those episodes to work on. And crucially, I had the books to work on. Mm-hmm. So one of the books, the third book, briefly forgotten what it's called, Towers of Silence, I think, is written from Sarah's point of view. It's written in the I character as Sarah. So, I mean, that's like miles and miles deep of information, of food to get out of there, of nourishment for the character. And I loved it so much. And I was doing a play at the same time. I was doing The White Devil. Vittoria Corombone, that amazing character, and a really good production actually of The White Devil, touring around, and I remember we didn't do any tapes then. You couldn't do self tapes, so I'd have to go back to London and go and meet them and read another scene and then go back down to Devon or wherever I was to do the play. And one day I was doing a matinee in Barnstable, I think. And I got a note on my desk saying, please ring your agent at the interval. And I thought, don't think I will. I don't want to throw myself in an interval when I've got another after the rest of the play to do. So I waited till the end of the play and it said, ring your agent. And I rang the beloved and wonderful and unmatchable Julian Belfridge. And he said, where are you, darling? And I said, I'm in Taunton. That's where I was, the Brewhouse Taunton. He said, do they sell champagne? And I said, I don't know. And he said, will you go and buy some? You've been offered Sarah Leighton in The Jewel and the Crown. And the whole cast went out and said, and it was such a huge, because it had literally taken since March until that was November or December. So it was.
And when you're reading, so with a book, you know, a play like that, or a screenplay like that, where you've got the books and you've got the screenplay that has been written and completed, are you looking in the book to find out what's missing in the screenplay? Are you thinking, what can I influence this? Or are you looking at both entities, the book and the screenplay, and creating the character from them? Are you making notes? Are you writing stuff down? How are you creating Sarah for yourself?
One of the first things I said to Christopher and Jim when they met me, I told them about Sarah and they said, okay, go away and read. I think they gave me four episodes or something to read. And I read them and I went back and they said, what did you think of the scripts? And I said, honestly, I said, I'm afraid I don't think they get anywhere near the books. I just found them very sort of thin and a bit super. I was really surprised by them. And Christopher beamed at me and he said, of course. He said, that's a book. This is a film. We will have India. You'll be able to see India. You'll be able to feel all the heat and everything else. We will fill all that in. That is the nature of filming. I was very inexperienced in film. Mm-hmm. And you will bring to this the acting, all of you actors will bring out all that texture that you're finding in the book. That's your job. And that was one of the first things he said to me. And I went off and did that. I went off and found the texture within the books. And I had to work quite hard on my voice because it was such an extraordinary, that sort of British India. And I went for Celia Johnson, yes, was my inspiration. And I think I overdid it rather, but anyway, we all had to sort of do a bit of work on our voices and it makes you behave slightly differently. And I'd work on that. Yeah. And I've always, with any character I ever play, I always go on the tube and look at people, which actually wasn't much use for Jewel in the Crown. But I had been in India, so I had that sort of sense of that clutter and chaos and noise and thrill.
But also Raj. I mean, you know, having done Gandhi, I mean, you know, you're steeped in that sense of this British colonial, yeah, sort of life, aren't you? Yeah. You know, it is about the character you play, and yeah, Gandhi isn't that, but yeah, he's surrounded by that. Yeah, he's totally taking that on. And,
absolutely,
you know, so your research, this is the other thing I love, is that your research for this role over here, you know, is, it keeps you in good stead for this other role that comes up, you know, and I love that you can hand those things on to each character that you're inhabiting.
Yeah.
But also you said we had India. You also had Manchester, didn't you?
Yes, which was an entirely different setup. We were in India for 6 months doing all the exteriors and then moved up to Manchester to do the interiors of all those scenes that we'd shot the exteriors for. So literally you come out and say, oh, hello, come in for breakfast. And you walk through a hot door in Delhi, yeah, and you're in a freezing cold studio in Manchester.
Six, seven months later.
Yeah. And often with me at slightly different size, because I tend to go out. So they sort of go, Geraldine, you've got to breathe in a bit because this is the dress you wore in this scene 1 second before, and you're walking through the door and it's now looking a little bit tight on you. So there were all those sort of things that went on. And that was very challenging, and that was really difficult to do because of the atmosphere we're in. And I mean, they can create all sorts of things in a studio, obviously, mm-hmm, but you had to, thank God we'd been to India first, because we could remember that heat and that the feeling of the sort of hotness coming down over your head, and it sort of slows you up when you're that hot.
Would you, when you got to Manchester, say you were walking out of a scene that had been shot in India and you were walking into a studio in Manchester, would Chris and Jim show you the scene, yeah, before? So you, yeah, would have that.
Yes.
But your own self, would you sort of be making notes about that time? Would you talk about your own energy and what?
Oh, yes. I mean, I write. I haven't got one here, but I write huge amounts in my script about why I'm there, what I'm there for, what I'm doing, and crucially, what I've just done, yes, particularly in this instance, because if, you know, I had to write down whatever it was that was going on in the outside, very excited that Ahmed has turned up, to get him to meet the family, know they're going to be critical of him because he's an Indian. How am I going to deal with this? Deep breath, you know, Mildred, mother's going to be trouble, and all that sort of storing up for myself. And I would really, that was my Bible. I mean, I used to keep that very, very close to my heart. I had huge notebooks and diaries. Yeah. So I had diaries of all the shooting days in India.
Do you always do that now? Is that something that is that become part of how you work?
I hope so. I might have got a bit lazy sometimes, but for me, almost the best bit of the job is the research aspect of it, and is finding out what it's like to live in 17th century England. You know, I had this dream, I've never done it, but when I was at Drama Centre, I wanted to make this thing a sort of timeline of history, and put it up on as a sort of frieze all around my room so that I could go, this play is set in 1895 Germany. Who was on the throne in England? Who was writing music in in England, who was painting pictures in France, who was cooking food in Italy, whatever it was, place this event of the story I'm doing, put it into history and find out as much as I can about that history around it. And I mean, that is such a fantastic privilege just to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's my favorite bit as well. Yeah. I love that. I love that. And also that thing of don't presume that, you know, this person can get from this place to this place without having to go through
spending all days.
The timeline, what wages are, what his circumstances are, the sort of conventions of the time. And, sometimes, you like all those things, you have to sort of know the rules in order to break them. But I think you have to know the history in order to know that you might have to do some sort of artistic license in it.
Yes. And then you do. And I mean, very often a script you'll read a script and you'll go, oh, well, that's not quite right for what I've discovered in truth. So then you have to make the script has to work. So you have to bring whatever you can from reality in order to make it work, to make the character work for you and for it.
It was such a, because it was Granada and sort of that sort of costume drama had been very much a BBC sort of show to make. There was quite a lot of pressure around that production, I should imagine. That, you know, it was quite lavish. It wasn't as, you know, you'd done Gandhi and obviously that had a film budget and all these extras and stuff, but it was still a big budget production. Did you feel the weight of that?
They obviously did. It was huge because it was to take a British crew and shoot for 6 months in India, all around. We were all around India. Mm-hmm. And Dennis Foreman had the idea of doing the Paul Scott books. And he started, in order to find out how to do it, he started with staying on. And he did that first to see what it was like, to see if it was possible to shoot in India. And met people there. There was a cook on Gandhi, our chef, you know, the guy doing all the food for this British crew. We had a British crew and an equal-sized Indian crew on Gandhi, which was amazing. So lunch, you could either have an English lunch or an Indian lunch. But the guy, Phil Neville, I think his name was. No, that's a footballer.
Yeah. I don't think he would have been there.
Anyway,
commentating on it.
This caterer, I just at one point said, these leeks, you cook leeks, this is amazing. We're in Rajasthan. And he said, I'm going round. He said, I'm doing a big series next year for Granada based on the Raj Quartet. And I'm planting vegetables now here for this film Gandhi that we will then use next year. I mean, what?
Wow.
He was choosing cows to sort of bring on to whatever they do. Yeah. And that was so exciting to see what's going on behind this huge production. So it was massive. Yeah. And we had wonderful Indian sort of organizers. Varmik Thapa, who is a brilliant nature photographer, he was our sort of make-do man. He'd go and talk to the police to make sure we could shoot in that village and we'd only be there for 2 days or whatever it was, finding places, an enormous crew. I mean, it was massive. And I remember about 3 weeks in, somebody coming up and saying, they are thrilled with the rushes. They're absolutely thrilled. And they've given us, they don't want to cut the rushes, so they're going to give us an extra episode. That's never happened to me before.
That's amazing.
You know, it was extraordinary. And Charlie and I did the first day. we did a scene in a haveli up in Rajasthan in this beautiful Lake Palace Hotel.
Oh, it's a beautiful scene.
Incredible. Well, that was the first day shoot.
No.
Yes, that was day one. And they have a ceremony in India on movies where they have a sort of ritual that they go through. This sweet sort of sadhu came in all his robes with a coconut, and he wanted to crack the coconut over the camera to give us good luck. And Ray Good and Christopher were going, no, not thank you so much. That's marvelous, but please not on the camera. It's a little bit precious.
Crack it on Charles's head.
I'll do it on Charles's head. It's a much better idea.
I mean, you know, you were all very young at that time. It was sort of there's you and Julian and Charles and stuff. But then you had people like Eric Porter.
Oh my God! And Peggy Ashcroft.
And Peggy, and I was about to ask you about Peggy. She became a real mentor for you, didn't she? She became a great friend.
She became a huge friend. And she was in America doing a play, doing All's Well, when we were rehearsing. We had about a five-day read-through or something on Jewel, and Peggy wasn't there. So Tim, Judy Parfitt and I had to go up with Jim and Christopher to Peggy's house in Hampstead to read through her scenes with her. It was the first time I'd met Peggy Ashcroft. I was a dresser. When I left school, I was a dresser at the Aldwych with the Royal Shakespeare Company. And I used to work, I worked with Liz Spriggs when she was doing Delicate Balance with Peggy. And I used to stand in the wings and watch it because I was a theatre person. I just used to stand and watch all the time. And one day Peggy saw me in by the stage door and she said, "Hello, I don't know who you are." And I said, my name's Geraldine and I'm Liz's dresser. And she said, "You're interested in the theatre, aren't you?" And I went, "Yes, I'd like to be an actress." She said, "I've seen you watching. Keep going, dear." And that was my introduction to Peggy. So the first time I met her was in her house doing this read-through. And we read these scenes. And Jim came up to me afterwards and went, "What's the matter?" He said, "Why didn't you, you weren't there. You were totally disengaged. You read that appallingly badly." And I went, "It was Peggy Ashcroft. It was my huge heroine. I mean, she was so glorious." And I was just totally overwhelmed to be literally in her presence. And she poured us all tea and she was adding milk to cups of tea. And every time she asked somebody if they wanted milk, she said milk in a slightly different way. She went, "Milk? Milk? Milk?" And I was very odd. And then she said at the end, she said, "Christopher, which way do you think Barbie would say milk?" And she was trying out how Barbie Batchelor, her character, she was getting in, she was doing it. She was doing the work.
Brilliant.
And I just...
all the time.
All the time. And which blouse? I mean, she was just fabulous. I loved her. And we became extremely good friends.
And you both won Best Actress at Venice Film. You shared it for She's Been Away, which is an amazing film.
And she sent me a... she sent me a telegram, which I still have, that says, "Laurel, rejoicing, love, Hardy."
That's so fantastic. But was it important for you to have someone in your life who was, you know, was she a mentor? I know she was a friend, but could you go to her and sort of talk about insecurities?
Completely. When I did Cymbeline at the National, she was my, years later, she sort of talked me through it. She talked to me about the character, Imogen, and she was so kind and so resolute. She was incredibly strong, Peggy, and quite rude and quite sexy. She was always talking about sex and just fabulous. And she was, and she came, oh no, it was after she saw Merchant of Venice, which I also did with, the film we did was with Peter Hall. Yeah. I then did Cymbeline for Peter and then Merchant of Venice. And the best thing that happened to me in The Merchant of Venice was Peggy coming around after the first night and walking into my dressing room and going, "Every golden word," and then going out again.
Oh, how wonderful. Wonderful. I mean, I think that passing it on in a way, there's a sense of having that mentor figure. I had one in my life, which was the actor James Hazeldean.
Oh, did you? Jimmy was fabulous.
I went with Jimmy when I was like 17.
Did you? And of course.
And he became such a great friend of mine. Sadly, he's no longer with us. No. But it was very important for me in my younger life as an actor to sort of just have a touchstone of someone who I could say, "I'm feeling this, I'm feeling that, I don't know what I'm doing, I don't," you know, just to say, we all feel like that.
Yes,
that's okay.
Exactly.
You know, it's okay. Just walk bravely into it. You know, there is no wrong sort of stuff.
And do you do it? You was talking about working at schools. Do you work with...
Yeah, I try to. Yeah. I mean, I really do. I think a part of doing this podcast is the sense that, you know, there is a lot about our profession that is slightly mystifying to people
totally.
When you're on the outside.
And completely inaccurate.
Yeah. And one of the other things for me growing up, which I wanted to talk to you about, is when my first encounter with actors was when I went to the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool and they'd all hang out in the foyer. And I went up to all of them. There's people like Anton Lesser and Pete Bothersweth. And I felt like I was being a nuisance. None of them treated me like I was being a nuisance.
No.
All of them were open and stuff. And it was great. But where was that for you? Was it school for you that you first got the bug? Was it a school play or anything?
Well, apparently it was home. I actually, I was looking for some photographs for somebody who's just having her 70th, who was a great friend of mine when we were little. And I was talking to her sister, and I'd found these photographs of us all dressed up as gypsies skunkling about in the garden. And she said, you know, you were always writing plays and bossing us about and being a director. And she said, you were always telling us what to say and where to go. So I think it started very young. I think it was about trying to find a voice for myself. I think I felt quite crushed in a way at home, certain aspects of it. And in order to find out who I was, I probably spoke too loudly. And I was very sort of extrovert. I was always doing handstands and climbing trees. I was a real tomboy. Mm-hmm. And I used to write epic poems, and I mean epic, terrible, terrible yarns about medieval princesses and knights and all of that that went on for hours. And I used to write reams and reams and reams.
And did you read? Did you read stuff voraciously? Was that?
Yes, I was a huge reader. But I used to read. I used to charge. They had these curtains in the drawing room, and I used to charge people to come and listen to me reading.
Well, that is great. You commercialize it right off the bat. That's brilliant. What was your charge?
I can't remember.
Well, that shows a very, very good head on your shoulders. Because you've also said that, you know, you went to a posh school, but you weren't particularly posh yourself. Is there an element there of reinventing yourself?
Totally, completely. Yeah. I failed my 11 plus because I was so miserable and unhappy at home because things were awful around then. Mm-hmm. And I remember coming down to breakfast, my father saying, oh, well, then she's got to go to Down House because I'd failed my 11 plus. And I felt, I mean, I was always sort of, no, I was never quite top of my class, but I was usually second or third, much to my father's fury that I wasn't first. I was, but being second was absolutely not worth it. Anyway, so I was obviously fairly capable, but I completely screwed up my 11 plus. So I couldn't go to the grammar school where I was mm-hmm. meant to go. So I went to this school that my sister's godmother had gone to called Down House, which is actually a fantastic school, but it is all girls and it's boarding. And when I went there in 1962, it was terrifying. I was 11. I was very young because my little school had packed up, closed early or something. And I just remember being completely overwhelmed, and I was quite badly bullied for the first couple of terms. And you, in those places, you have to find who you are in order to be able to stand up in the crowd, not stand above the crowd, just be part of it. And if you feel downtrodden and you're squashed down, you will be, you know, you'll be trodden on. Mm-hmm. So I had to learn quite quickly. And my mum had sent all the wrong clothes because she was so hopeless. I had all the wrong clothes. So I used to get laughed at. Mm-hmm. And we weren't allowed home more than 3 weekends a term or something ghastly. So I became the class clown. And I had a pencil tin. I remember it. And after lunch on Friday, I had this silly pencil tin that sort of the lid didn't shut properly and it clicked. It made a noise. And I just did a sort of silent routine in the sort of style of Buster Keaton. I like to think, but it probably wasn't. But people used to sit around and just roar with laughter at this thing. And one day the English teacher, Theo Barnsley, came in early and she said, I think I'm going to put you in a play. Right. And he sort of said it as if it was punishment. Right, if you're going to start showing off before my English lesson, you can go into a play. So I started going to plays and I found myself. I mean, it was absolutely extraordinary. And then I had a wonderful teacher and found Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And then I was home and dry, really.
It's amazing that, though, isn't it? That, I mean, that when you find it, I mean, I had it in my junior school. I too failed my 11 plus, but in my junior school, I did some plays. And I remember just going, oh, this is, I equated it with somebody who could suddenly find they could kick a football or yes. hit a tennis ball or whatever. I suddenly went, oh, I know how to do this in some way.
Aren't we lucky, though, to have found that?
Yeah, when I failed my 11 plus, the school I went to did no drama at all. And I really missed it. And it was that it was missing it that made me go, what's happened here? And I had to go and find it again.
But how did you find it?
Well, I did that thing of I walked up to people and said, hi, my name's David. I want to be an actor. And I've always being so grateful to grow up in Liverpool, where the arts were taken really seriously. It's a cultural city. It's very proud of its culture. So nobody really took the mickey out of me for doing that. They just asked me why I didn't want to be in a band. But some people said, oh, have you tried the Everyman? Have you tried, you know, and I found the Everyman and I went in and I was welcomed in. And that's
and that was Dosser's time.
Was it that was just after Dosser. Yeah. Was it? So it was Peter James was the main director then. And, you know, so it was really inclusive, you know, and it wasn't.
I auditioned there hundreds of times. I was too posh. They all told me I was too posh.
Was that when Jonathan Pryce was running?
No, it was before that. It was Dosser and it was Dosser. Matt Kelly was there, Julie, Walters, Pete.
Yeah.
It was great times. And
Nick
I was
Wooderson, there's that great photograph of
Nick
them
Wooderson.
All outside.
Yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. And they did that wonderful cabaret show they used to do.
Yeah, they did the Liverpool
cabaret. I loved that place. I used to go and see them. And they couldn't get in. They said I was too posh. So I adopted a very curious Cockney accent for a while. Because in those days, in the early 70s, it was very unuseful to be posh in any way, and I had been to this ridiculously posh school, so I did sound a little bit peculiar.
We'll be back with more chat after this.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, you're listening to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Now, back to this week's episode.
But when you had the idea that you could do it as a profession, I mean, it's true that, did your father kick you out? It didn't go down well, did it?
Not at all. He said, no, I have paid a fortune sending you to this expensive school. You will not be an actor. Absolutely not. And if you insist, that's it, as far as I'm concerned, you're out. So I was out, and not only that, but the old bastardo said that I was living at home so he could claim some sort of tax relief. So I didn't get any grant. I mean, I didn't get a grant anyway because he had too much money, but I didn't even get a living grant. And I was at Christopher Fettes at Drama Centre, and I said, I can't afford to be here. And he said, well, you'll have to leave. You've got a rich daddy. Go and talk to your local council. So I went to Reading, and they said, but your father's claiming that you live at home. And I said, I don't live at home. I haven't lived at home since he threw me out. So in the end, they did give me a grant. And he, in the end, we became extremely good friends, thank God.
And, but you had to be successful to become
that. I had to be successful. I had to be nominated for my first BAFTA nomination. I've never achieved the thing. But my first nomination, he sent me a check for £100 and said, buy yourself a nice frock.
But that must have been, I mean, you know, we can pass over that, but that must have been a really traumatic time for you. Here you are embarking on something which is not in your family. You know, they don't know anything about it. It's a completely new sort of furrow you're plowing for yourself. And you haven't got the support of your family. That's quite a lonely...
But in a way, that made me stand up. That made me, I auditioned for every drama school going and got turned, RADA told me I'd fallen like a horse at the first hurdle. I got into Central, Webber Douglas and Lambda, I think. But somebody said, you should go to the Drama Centre. Go to the Drama Centre and do an audition. And I went to this place and met these five people and just came out and went, I don't care. I will come back here and audition till they take me in. I thought they were fabulous. And they did take me in. And I remember at the end of my first term, walking up Haverstock Hill And I haven't been religious since I was about 13, but actually thanking some great power for giving me the huge privilege of going to that school and of doing it on my own, of doing it without the support, because it just made me, it brought the grit. You know, I had to do it. I had to work really hard. I couldn't rely on that. Every single holiday I was working in as a sort of secretary somewhere in Park Lane, and I was at Gordon's Gin or somewhere in the Irish Tourist Board, and doing all this temporary work all through the holidays, because I had to pay, and I used to sing in a pub in the evenings or be a barmaid. Yeah, it was amazing, and it helped me find who I was.
On the podcast, we also had Derek Jacobi at one point, and he said that. I said to him, what advice would you give? And he said, you know, if you want to be an actor, don't be an actor. But if you have to be an actor, be an actor. And I thought that was great. And there's something in that story of you saying that, you know, there is no choice.
Well, that's it. And, you know, when I love working with young actors. I get a little bit bored of being the oldest person by miles in every cast I'm ever in now, but never mind. But meeting young actors, and they just sort of, some of them, you just go, no, you haven't got the, you have to not be able to do anything else. If there's an alternative, if you go, well, I'll try it for a bit. Although when I left drama school, I didn't think I'd ever get work. And I thought, I'll try it. I left when I was 22, and I thought, I'll give it till I'm 30. And if it's not working, I'll give up, because I've been told by everybody under the sun that this is going to be absolutely useless and it's not going to work. But I'd seen Janet Sussman doing Chekhov on the telly, directed by Jonathan Miller, and thought, God, look at that. Wouldn't that be incredible? I'd seen Eric Porter play Lear and just got completely overwhelmed by the genius of that language and all the rest of it. And I started off in rep very slowly, but it sort of was happening. And then it got to the point where I was sort of nearly 30, and I thought, this is actually beginning to be really good fun. I actually bought my own flat when I was 30. And that was unheard of. I mean, incredible. No help from anybody.
But talk me through Dummy, because Dummy, it's a big job for you, isn't it? You're front and centre of it. It's a massive, I couldn't find it. I've not seen it, so I couldn't find it.
There's an injunction taken out on it. It was a true story written by it's Frank Rodham, who went on to do great things with MasterChef.
Yes,
it's Frank
Rodham. Transformed British television with MasterChef.
Totally. World television, I think you'd say. Hugh Whitemore did the adaptation of this true story of this. He read a headline saying, deaf prostitute goes to prison for manslaughter. And he thought, wow, I wonder how that happened. So they researched this amazing character, fabulous young woman up in Bradford, and created this story. And then Frank had to cast it. I'd done an audition for Patsy Pollock, wonderful, wonderful Patsy Pollock, who was casting director at the Royal Court. And I did a sort of general audition, and she gave me my first job in London theatre was understudying Jane Asher in Christopher Hampton's play Treats, which was very, very exciting. I never got on, but anyway, it was good fun. And so Patsy knew me from that. She then cast one episode of The Sweeney, and there was one episode that had a very good part for a girl, and she got me that part, which was my first ever telly. And I thought I was very glamorous. I played a sort of croupier girlfriend of Dennis Waterman's. Then, like a few months later, I didn't have an agent, and somebody rang me up and said, somebody saw you on telly last night in The Sweeney and wants to meet you for a film. Go to this place and this place. And I thought, oh, God, help. I was a croupier. I'll have to be very, very smart. And I'm never smart, but I got very dressed up for me, went to this place, and there was Frank Rodham, and he opened the door and he said, oh, good, you're not too smart. And I thought, damn, I thought I was doing really well. But he thought I was good and sort of ordinary. And he told me this story of this girl who had had this extraordinary life up in Bradford as profoundly deaf and had ended up in prison. And he said, I'm interested in you playing this part. And I just went, why? How extraordinary. He said that I've played a croupier. Anyway, and of course it was everything I've ever wanted to do. in an acting part. He wouldn't be able to do it now because, quite rightly, he should have had a deaf actress. And he thought about trying to find a deaf actress, but he said he had to do it so quickly and it was so difficult because it was a drama documentary. So we were in the real places. We were absolutely, there were only about three actors in it. Otherwise, it was all real people. So he had to be able to communicate with me very directly. So he decided he had to have a hearing actress. And he said, I will give you 6 weeks to prepare this part. And I want you, you've got to convince everybody in England that you are profoundly deaf. I mean, talk about an acting challenge. And it was, but it was
complete. And what did you do in that?
I went up to Bradford and I worked with the woman's real social worker. And I went to a lot of deaf clubs and I learnt her signing. She refused to learn signing. And had her own way of communicating that was absolutely brilliant and very feisty. And then Frank got very worried that doing all that would be too big on the screen. He said, you've got to keep it down. You think, you know, I mean, it is what it is. Yeah. But I had 6 weeks and I remember working on this. There's a very good school near me in South London for deaf people. And I just went there all the time and just watched these children and listened to them and saw how they communicate. And the thing I love about deaf people, the joy you see communicating, you see them at bus stops and it's this wonderful, real communication.
But all that research that you're doing in that 6 weeks and with the other job, all your other jobs that you've done, the research, that's your own initiative, isn't it? You're doing that. I mean, production can set things up sometimes, but you're doing it. I think that's the thing for me that I learned was don't wait for them to set up the meeting. You get
in there. Oh, God, absolutely. No, absolutely.
You know, you find your own research. Go and find those places. Do that yourself. Nobody's going to set that up.
No, absolutely. They put me in touch with a social worker. Mm-hmm. I couldn't see her because she was in prison. She came out of prison, was around on the shoot, but she would, when I was preparing, she wasn't. But they set me up with the social worker, but otherwise it was entirely me. And I went off and I did a day when I thought I'm going to do this. And I pretended to be deaf. I went into shops and asked for things as a deaf person. And I remember hearing people laughing at me and just going, that's a key. That's what deaf people do. They see that you're laughing at me. They don't hear that you're laughing at me, but they see it. Yeah. And I learned such a lot about just being a human being, doing that job. And being in the roughest streets of Bradford. I love that place. I love Bradford. Mm-hmm. And I met fantastic people there.
Band of Gold later
and
on.
And then Band of Gold, which was great because they went, you've been in Jewel in the Crown. You can't possibly do Band of Gold. And I'm hang on. This is what I do.
That's what I mean about bringing those characters from your past into the ones you're doing now and stuff. And those research, I mean, God, my bookshelves are so all over the place with that sort of stuff, but it always comes in handy for different roles.
Yeah.
So there's so much we could talk about, but just to jump forward a bit. So when you're doing Portia in Merchant of Venice with Peter Hall, you're working with Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
Now that's a very different dynamic. That's sort of a big production. It's bells and whistles on it. It's, you know, it's going to be a lot of eyes are going to be on it.
Terrifying.
Are you approaching that type of work and that type of character in any different way to what you would be doing in your television roles?
Well, Peter Hall has a wonderful, I loved working with him on Shakespeare. He said, you don't have to do any work at all on these characters because it's all in the words. It's all in the verse. He would use the verse. So you don't have to think about what's my character like here. You just, it is in the words. You say the words and you will be the character. And that's an extraordinary thing to experience. You've got to have a writer of the caliber of Shakespeare to be able to do that, but you know, you've done those.
Yes. And
it's so that was completely extraordinary. The pressure was of doing the Dustin was one of the first Americans to come and do Shakespeare in London. Mm-hmm. And he'd apparently got in touch with Peter and said he wanted to come to London to do Shakespeare. And Peter said, any idea what you'd like to play? And he said, yes, I'd like to play Hamlet. And Peter went, have you done any Shakespeare? I said, no, none. And he said, could start with something, you know, Hamlet's great, but let's start with maybe Malvolio. or maybe Shylock. And he went for Shylock. And I'd done Cymbeline for Peter a couple of years before, and then back the film. And he came up to me and he said, "I want you to play Portia in Merchant of Venice." And I went, "Oh, she's so mealy-mouthed. She's such an extraordinary, such a weird character. I don't know if I really want to play that. Who's playing Shylock?" And he said, "Dustin Hoffman." And I went, yeah, okay. That's interesting. Maybe I could have a look at this. So obviously, I mean, and of course, working on Portia, she's the most fantastic character. I mean, I played her for a year, 6 months in London and 6 months in New York, and I did not lose. I mean, I wasn't bored for 1 second. And a lot of that was down to Dustin Hoffman, because he is so incredibly present and there and alive on the stage. He never repeats anything, which can be very alarming, of course. But
and do you think that's as simple as saying that he's an American method actor, or do you think it's to do with his schooling as opposed to our schooling?
I feel that Americans have an affinity with Shakespeare that we don't have. I think that there's something about the tone of American that actually goes along with maybe it's more similar to rural Warwickshire. Wow. than certainly than RP. Because it's not a clip language at all. It's like jazz. Shakespeare is jazz. So that's more American than British. And I think once he got, he was furious that he couldn't improvise. He'd come in and go, I want to say this. And he'd go off on great spiels of all this. And Peter would go, "Yes, that's very interesting. But can we just, let's have a look at this scene, see if we can make this work." And Dustin worked incredibly hard and came in one day and said, "I've just realized you can't improvise this shit." You're quite right.
That should be on a t-shirt. That is great. But it's interesting, the RP thing, though, because I remember when I first got to the RSC, I was so intimidated by the whole thing. And Sis Berry got hold of me and we were doing some of the speeches. And she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm doing what you're supposed to. I'm talking like that." And she said, "Just do it as yourself. Just do it in your own voice." And suddenly it just started to come alive for me. And it was amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It was such a huge production. And, you know, you go to Broadway. How was that experience for you, going with the big Shakespearean play with a big, huge Hollywood star? You know, what was that like?
Well, it was sort of easier for me because all the pressure was on him.
Right.
You know, people were coming into that. Nobody had a clue who I was. They were coming to see Dustin Hoffman on stage, which he'd been in. He'd done Death of a Salesman. Fairly recently in America, hugely successfully with John Malkovich, I think. But this was Dustin doing Shakespeare, Dustin playing Shylock in New York. You know, this was huge for him. And he was terrified. He lost his voice when we opened in London because he was so unused to playing. We were in the Phoenix Theatre, and it's quite a sort of long theatre. You have to reach quite far back.
Microphones.
Absolutely.
Now everybody wears microphones.
Yeah, no, none at all. And he had lost his voice, and it was difficult, but he found it, and he found his way of doing it, and he was brilliant. And when he got to New York, he was home. He was playing his character at home.
And did he change? The character? Yeah.
Yes, he was. He was much naughtier. Right. He was as Shylock. I mean, Shylock became a little sort of imp, and he'd sit on the edge of the stage and swing his legs. And I mean, I went out with one in the trial scene where Portia turns up dressed as a lawyer, male lawyer, and the first line is, "Which is the merchant here, and which the Jew?" And because Antonio and Shylock are arguing, and she comes in to try and solve it. And I walked onto the stage one night, no Dustin. Lee Lawson was standing there, everybody else was standing there, no Dustin. And I thought, "Oh God, what's he doing?" So I went, "Which is the merchant here? And where is the Jew?" and Dustin came up, he put his head up from under a desk with his thumbs up like that. He was so thrilled.
Oh, wonderful.
And he just, so he'd set up things like, he'd sort of test you, which was actually once you knew the character and the play so well, you could sort of give as good as you got, and it was absolutely fabulous. And he wanted to do Taming of the Shrew with me. We were going to do Petruchio and Kate, and it never happened. He got Spielberg into it and said he tried to get him to do it, but he was understandably not interested. Anyway, we never did it, but it was quite a nice thought.
But is there a difference for you in building a character when you're looking at a film or television or theatre, or is it always the same sort of process for you? Is the difference just purely technical, as in breathing and voice and stuff like that? When you're building a character, is there any difference?
No, I don't think there is, other than this Shakespeare thing that you just don't have to worry about building the character in Shakespeare. With a play, the last play I did was a play about T. Lawrence, and I played Charlotte Shaw.
And Lawrence of Arabia.
Lawrence of Arabia. Yeah. I had to do a lot of research on that to find out about her. And she was fabulous, of course, much more fabulous, in fact, than in the play. Didn't give her enough time. But anyway, no, I'd absolutely do the research and find out. And I always have a secret. I always try to have a secret as a character, whatever it might be. And it is a secret. I keep it as a secret, because it gives you a sort of inner place to go to if you get very nervous, which I do less now, but I used to get fantastically nervous on stage. I think we all have our true histories inside us. When we're playing a character, we can't because we've just been playing it for 4 weeks. So to give us, it gives you a sort of background somehow, and some depth, and just to know something that I know that you don't know and that you don't need to know and that I'm not going to tell you it gives you a little bit of heft, I think. That
and that can change as well. I mean, during a production, particularly with Shakespeare, I think there's something that I constantly feel when I'm doing Shakespearean roles, that as I'm going along in the run, everything will start to sort of illuminate in a different way. It keeps giving to me in a way.
Isn't
that
fantastic?
It's a weird. And that thing of something will happen in my life, or I read something in the paper or whatever, or I see something on the news, and then I'll go to the theatre that night and I'll go, well, I never thought of this.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And that's what I love about the theatre. That's what's so wonderful about taking your day into the theatre, and everybody else is coming to the audience, and they've all got their day, and the audience has that energy, and it's different every night, isn't it? And you just get a different feel from the audience, and they've all been different places, and everybody's bringing different stuff into the theatre. And I miss it very much. I really want to do a play.
And how are you at the end of aren't you able to leave a job? Are you able to leave the character behind, at the end of the night or the end of the filming day? Do you carry it around with you at all?
Only to my husband. I really do carry it around. I did Death and the Maiden for 6 months, Errol Dorfman play. Yeah. And he said, oh, when's this play finishing? Because that was, inevitably, if you're in a place that's very, very dark and difficult, it's quite hard to get out of. And I used to think that a film or TV job, I would take as long to get out of the character as I had played the character for. That stopped with Jewel and the Crown. Yes, 18 months was too long.
You couldn't carry that around.
For 18 months. But you have to shed it. I mean, I'm shedding a character now. I've just finished something now. And I miss a character who I actually stopped playing 2 or 3 years ago in Canada. And I still miss her because she responded with the character Anne with an E. It was a version of Anne of Green Gables. And I played Marilla Cuthbert, which she's the most wonderful character. And it was very, very difficult to do. And I found it very hard to get into her. But once I was there, we did 3 series, I found her quite magnificent to play because there was so much to do. It's like Shakespeare. You suddenly go, oh, and there's that. And you can go down that channel down there and explore that. And that's interesting. I'd never even considered that she could be like that. Oh, there's that over there. And I find her really quite hard to shed. I literally miss her. I miss the character.
Yeah, I have characters like that where I just suddenly feel very alive and about the fact that, oh, he could do that, he could do that. And then they go, oh, but you're not playing him anymore.
No.
And it's so strange.
That's right. And they've gone.
And hard to explain to anybody who's not in our. But your husband is a director, isn't he? So
he's a director, yes.
So you're in the same world. But it's so, it's hard sometimes to explain.
I know. I really feel for people who haven't got that sort of support. Mm. Because if somebody didn't understand, that would be tough.
Yeah.
I'm very lucky.
And I can, like you said, that thing of taking characters home. I don't tend to do that, but I do take the mood of a piece with me because I'm slightly, a bit like a wobbly tooth. I can't stop sticking my tongue in there a little bit. I need to sort of be inside that in order to sort of give vent to it in a way.
Yes, that's right.
And you mentioned nerves before. Is that something, how did you conquer that or did you just get used to it? Was there anything that you did to sort of get over the nerves?
When I was doing the T.E. Lawrence play, I did an evening for Shakespeare's birthday somewhere in the city. And Fiona Shaw was there and I was talking to her and we were talking about the play. And I said, I'm at Hampstead Theatre. And I said, I get really nervous. And she said, why do you get nervous? She said, you've done it. You don't have to be nervous anymore. And I went, don't I? Do you know? People know, you know, you've done it. You've done the groundwork. And I thought, oh, I wasn't nervous anymore. I mean, it was like a window opening. I mean, it was just such a simple thing to say. And she wasn't saying, you're marvelous. She was just saying, come on.
Did you feel, because I sometimes feel this myself, is that the nerves are a security blanket to me as well. Is there something about having the nerves that means that I'm doing it? And I can't let go of that sensation because I think, well, I can't let go of the nerves, otherwise I won't be able to do this.
Yes, absolutely. And I think nerves, to an extent, are important. But nerves can knock me for six. When I was doing Merchant once, Dustin came up and said, and her name begins with M, just before we started the play. And I went, what? Her name begins with M. Who is it? And I went, Meryl's in.
Oh my God.
And I could barely speak for the entire evening. And I went, Dustin, you completely screwed me for the whole night. And he said, it was Arthur Miller. And anyway, so that was nerves totally polaxing me in the most stupid way. Mm. And I have got better. I'm much better on camera. I feel very comfortable on camera. I don't know why.
Do you watch yourself on camera? Why is that though?
Because it's always so disappointing. It's right. I'm in here putting this out. And then I look at it. I go, no, that's not what I meant at all.
Oh. But even the finished article, you wouldn't sit down and watch something when it's all put
years
together.
Later. I mean, I don't know when I last watched Jewel. I watched a bit of Blot on the Landscape recently and did find it just so stupid. But some of it was quite sweet and quite funny. And but that was like years ago. I did watch Anne with an E, some of it, and was quite pleased. But it was because I was doing a Canadian accent and it was so frightening playing such an iconic Canadian character in Canada with a lot of Canadian actors going, why the hell is she playing this part? So I was just sort of checking that I'd got away with it in some way.
What are the biggest changes in the profession for you over the years? How has it changed?
It's become much more acceptable. I think it's extraordinary that at the moment, one of the most successful professions to be in is in the entertainment industry because everybody needs stuff on screen. Mm. There's so much work. And that just was not the case. I remember doing a parents' evening at my daughter's school, talking to people about the theatre and a father coming up to me and saying, how could you speak to these girls and encourage them to be actors? You mustn't. You must tell them to be doctors and lawyers and all the rest of it. And you go, oh, shut up. You know, if they're going to be actors, they're going to be actors. And there's much more opportunity now for women. The parts for women are, you know, I'm working more since I've been 60 than I did when I was 40. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know how long it'll go on for, but I just can, I feel so lucky. And I know it's tough. And I say to people, just do whatever you can and keep it. Don't try not to get into a rut. because I think actors do get stuck, and it's very difficult not to, because producers and directors go, we need somebody who is this tall, dark, thin and spiky.
Yeah,
she's done that, she can do it again, and that's inevitable. So we have to say, yes, but I can also do this, and we have to do everything we can
to change people's perception of us. Yeah, 100%. I think the other big change for me is what we touched on before, is the fact that you will do a television job now, which might be an 8 or a 10-parter, but they've only got 2 parts written. So as you're going along, and there's a point during the production that you catch up with the writers.
Yes.
And that's a very frightening, an unraveling of what you're doing. And you just have to get used to that.
Yes, to learn on the hoof overnight. Yeah. I mean, I hope my brain is in great shape, because I've had this thing I've just done, which was an American thing for Apple TV. And they were literally writing it the night before and going, we've changed this. And you look at it and go, whoa, where's this coming from? What's this? And you learn it and do it and talk about it on the day. And then the director goes, no, actually, I don't like that. So we'll go back to what it was before. And you're just in a sort of whirlwind. And I had to do a sort of press thing for this thing. And I just said, can I have all the scripts in their final shape so that I can see what on earth it is that I've been in? Mm-hmm. And it was completely different from when I'd read it in last July or whenever it was.
Do you think your old rep days helps you?
I hope so. I think 3 weekly reps set me up in very good stead. Dipping between Strindberg and Victorian melodramas.
Yeah, that'll help you with those rewrites.
I think it helps a lot.
And if you could, you know, meet yourself when you're in your early 20s, when you were coming out of drama school and stuff, what do you know what you would say to her? Do you know how would you give her any advice?
I'd say believe in yourself a bit more. You can, you know, if people say you can do it, just believe them. Don't argue with them. Don't say no. Don't diss yourself all the time. Because I always have been, for all sorts of reasons to do with history, but I've always been very good at putting myself down, at denying myself, at going, no, I'm not at all. And that's just silly. That's just tiring. And actually just go, yes, and keep on the front foot and keep moving forward and keep looking and keep believing that you can do the things you dream of doing and you want to do. It's to get out there and find them and do it, because it's such an amazing experience. I mean, I wouldn't change, and I've had really tough times. I wouldn't change a minute of the 50 years this year. I've been a professional actor, I suddenly realized the other day.
Well, congratulations on that.
That's probably time to stop to draw up my socks, but anyway.
Not at all. It's been so wonderful talking to you. It's a great point to end. I mean, it's been, looking through your work again has been just such a pleasure. I wish I could find Dummy, but, you know, there's so much. And thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, David. It's been great. I really enjoyed talking to you. And thank you. And thank you for doing this. I think this podcast is such a great idea. It's great.
Cheers.
Who Am I This Time is a Just Voices and Doolally production, produced by Simon Lennigan, music by Greg Hatlow, edited and mixed by Russ Keffert at Audio Egg, and presented by me, David Morrissey.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.